As director of web publishing for Nature Publishing Group, Timo Hene and his group are applying Web 2.0 principles to the realm of science. Their projects include a social bookmarking service as well as a social network. But science doesn't provide the same kind of incentives for participation as the general web does. On this week's Interviews with Innovators, host John Udell interviews Timo Hene to find out what he and his team are doing to change that. From IT Conversations. Hi, and welcome to IT Conversations. I'm Phil Windley, the executive producer. Today, I'm happy to bring you another edition of Interviews with Innovators with John Udell. This program is made possible by Microsoft's Channel 9 and Channel 10.
The Conversations Network is looking for part-time website editors and audio engineers. It's not enough to quit your day job, but we do pay small amounts for each published program. For more information, visit the conversationsnetwork.org website. Our audio files are delivered by Limelight Networks, the high-performance content delivery network for digital media. Thank you, Limelight, for your support of the Conversations Network.
And now, here's John Udell.
I've really wanted to have a chance to speak with you about a variety of things for a long time.
Pleasure.
I think you have one of the great jobs, Director of Web Publishing for Nature. How did you get there?
Well, I've worked for Nature for a long time now. I joined in 98, actually, in the Tokyo office. I was living in Japan. And even before that, I think back as far as 94, I was freelancing for Nature Medicine, actually, shortly after they launched it. Again, I was living in Japan at that time and writing sort of medical stories from Tokyo. So I joined them in 98. I was working on sort of online business development in Asia, but then I came over to the London office in late 2000, started getting involved in more online projects to do with the main website, nature.com. That was relatively soon after we'd sort of started putting all our content full text online, and there were lots of challenges associated with sort of reinventing the company around that. Mm-hmm. And I spent a while, we set up a new technology division that I ran for a few years, which was focused much more on technology-oriented R&D. It didn't have a remit to create user-facing products and services. But then about just over 2 years ago, our managing director decided that we ought to have a user-facing department, a publishing department, if you like, that, you know, seeks to exploit the web to its full. And so in her infinite wisdom, we set up Web Publishing, and I got tasked with running it. And we're just over 20 people now working on various projects.
But it's only been 2 years?
Since Web Publishing was founded, yeah.
Okay.
We've been doing some of the projects predate Web Publishing as a department. For example, Connoisseur, which is our sort of delicious for scientists.
Yeah, that's been more like 3 or 4 years, right?
Yeah, that's been going, I guess, 3.5 years, maybe something like that.
I
need to work it out. Actually, look at the calendar. But that's been going a little while now. But so we actually set that up when I was running New Technology, and it sort of accidentally became a user-facing service. We really set it up originally because we thought Nature should be doing something in that space, and it was really hard to explain to people who had no experience with Delicious what social bookmarking was. So we actually found it easier to create a simple prototype and show it to people.
Right.
And then it sort of became a user-facing service, sort of not quite by accident, but by stealth, if you like. Then when we set up the web publishing department, that department adopted Connoisseur as one of its sort of founding projects. But since then, we've launched a lot of other things as well.
So your profile on Connoisseur, which, as you said, is a social bookmarking service. Your profile says that you were trained as a neurophysiologist.
That's
and,
right.
And a biochemist.
Yeah.
From that perspective, something like Delicious, or more specifically Connoisseur, is or should be a dream come true, really, in terms of citation management, in terms of the ability to be aware not only of the resources that you're collecting in various categories, but of who else may be interested in those same things. All sorts of reasons why it makes an incredible amount of sense to want to use a tool like this. But when we met a couple of weeks ago, I think you said that it's actually still slow going in terms of getting lots of scientists on board with doing things this way.
Yeah, I mean, it's got a few tens of thousands of users, so it's not, you know, it's certainly, I mean, you're absolutely right to say it was inspired by Delicious. And of course, Delicious has millions of users. I mean, we wouldn't really expect Connoisseur to gain that kind of usage because it's aimed squarely at academics, particularly at scientists, which is a much smaller market. But even within that market, it's not yet a mainstream tool. So if you think that there's, you know, somewhere in the perhaps low millions of scientists around the world, it's still its penetration is relatively small. I think that's for a couple of reasons. I think one is that we still need to do a better job to make it into something that feels a bit less geeky and a bit less intimidating for people who aren't familiar with tagging and aren't familiar with things like Delicious, which still make up the vast majority of scientists.
Right.
The other aspect is that scientists are actually, by their nature, quite conservative. I mean, they don't, whilst they work to, you know, to further the frontiers of human knowledge, they, in their behavior, they're relatively conservative. And that's for a whole bunch of different reasons. And it's, of course, you know, there are exceptions to every rule, but I think it's certainly true that scientists haven't necessarily been the first to adopt various different web technologies or different approaches online. They're often looking elsewhere and then seeing it working, for example, with wikis. It was really only after the rise of Wikipedia, I think, that scientists really started taking wiki seriously as a way of sharing information.
Yeah.
You know, and what the way we work often is to look outside science and see what's working elsewhere and try and then adapt it and see how we can make use of it within a scientific research context. You know, and our job is to do that quickly and well rather than waiting for, you know, everyone to notice it. We try and be a little bit ahead of the curve in that respect, but we're often looking for inspiration outside.
It is fascinating, though, because in this particular case, what Kanatia does is so close to the heart of what the research process is, that you would think it would be a natural fit. Well, it is a natural fit.
It is, yeah. And I think, you know, I mean, the other thing to bear in mind is that lots of scientists already do use software for collecting their lists of reading and references. In particular, they use desktop software like EndNote. And there's a bunch of other packages as well. And those kinds of packages are also gradually sort of migrating online and becoming more collaborative and less standalone. But I think probably not in quite such a radical way as Delicious and Kanatia do. So people are moving in that direction. And I think one of the challenges with Kanatia at the moment, so whilst the people who use it find it really, really useful and we get a lot of good feedback, I think there's quite a leap for people to see, you know, they've got their reference collection or on a desktop application, you know, reference manager. Mm-hmm. And it's quite a leap for them. When they look at Kanatia, it doesn't look like a similar kind of thing, although the underlying functionality in many ways is similar, with some extra features as well, like the tagging and like the collaborative aspects of it.
So maybe it's the case that the collaborative aspects of it aren't yet that critical for what most scientists are doing most of the time. I mean, here I am in Kanatia, and I see that there's a tag that was recently used, endocytosis. Okay, and there are something like 100 things tagged with endocytosis, and there's a user, D Bridges, who's put a number of those in. And D Bridges can also see, you know, who are the other people who are using this tag, which, you know, in theory would be pretty interesting, right? Well, you know, who are these other people that are in my area, many of which I may not know about, right? Mm-hmm. Who may in turn lead me. I mean, this happens to me all the time in Delicious, is, you know, I sort of jump out of a resource into a tag, and from the tag I find other people, and then I find what those other people have tagged, and I kind of, you know, by following those pathways, discover all sorts of what feels like to me useful and serendipitous kinds of connections. But maybe that's not really relevant. I don't know. I mean,
yeah, well, no, I think it is. And I think, I mean, I use Kanatia in that way, and I think other users do as well. I just think it's, you know, a lot of scientists don't have the time or inclination to try out those things necessarily. And I think it's our job to make it as easy and obvious as possible. I think one of the elements of it is that Kanatia doesn't fulfill all the information needs that a scientist might have in that sort of general space. So, and we're trying, you know, there's a bunch of other projects that where we're trying to do things that are hopefully complementary to Kanatia, but also related to it in different ways. So, for example, Nature Network is, as the name suggests, a social networking site for scientists. You can think of it as a kind of LinkedIn or Facebook or whatever for scientists. Mm-hmm. And so that speaks to the idea that when you find someone's collection, you sort of see someone's collection or someone's tags, and you think, oh, this person shares interest in me, I want to find out more about them. Nature Network is a way to find out more about them, to look at who else they know, but also to look at their profile pages and see and to see where they've commented on the site and so on and so forth. Now, what we don't have at the moment is good integration between Kanatia and Nature Network. But as we go forward, we've got these various services. I expect them to become more integrated and for people to be able to hop from one to another and for the different applications to share information where appropriate in order to help people find the information they're looking for. So once Kanatia and Nature Network sort of work well together, it will be much easier to jump from someone's tag collection to information in Nature Network about their profile and their involvement in various discussions on that site, and also to be able to make contact with them as well. Similarly, you know, we've got another project called Scintilla, which is about content aggregation and filtering and personalization in the scientific space. That's a very new project. It's only been out for a very short time. But once again, I would expect some of that to become, that kind of functionality to become more integrated with Connoteer and with Nature Network and other ones. And for the applications not to become one huge monolithic application, but for them to start working sensibly together to provide functionality from one application within the context of another one. But we're still at an early stage. You know, we're trying to think about the different information needs that scientists have, and they are very multifaceted and rather complex, and we're trying sort of a bunch of individual experiments, but we're also trying to weave those together into something that's more than the sum of its parts, and we're really just at the beginning of that process so far.
So what do you think about the whole opening up the walled gardens question and federation and things like that?
The Facebook point in the context of a scientist, you know, would be, you know, well, why should I have an account, say, in Nature Network or a profile there when I've got my homepage, right? And I can, there are similar cases made for, you know, why do we need preprint servers or even journals? Because I can just put my papers on my website. I mean, obviously, unless those services are adding some value beyond what people can just do for themselves on the web, then they won't succeed and they don't deserve to succeed. The question is, can you create an environment in which there is value in participating? I think the other side of it is to try and keep these things open. I mean, one thing we've done with Connoteer is provide an API so that people can access the data and can make use of it in other contexts.
Yeah.
So, for example, we developed an add-on to ePrints, which is institutional repository software, so that it can use Connoteer data to provide kind of recommended reading, if you like, and links to related content around the web derived from Connoteer-based recommendations. So I think two things are, obviously those services have to add value beyond what people can do for themselves on the web, and then they also have to be open in some respects. I mean, you can't keep them closed and expect something to thrive, because the web is fundamentally an open medium, right? And things that you create need to be able to interact with other services, need to be able to share data, whether it's opening up an API or whether it's allowing third-party functionality in the way that Facebook has recently started allowing. And again, I mean, we're just kind of discovering. I mean, I don't have any grand answers, because we're on a voyage of discovery along with everyone else as to what works and what doesn't work.
One of the things that's happening here is that I think Facebook is going to introduce a whole lot of people to a bunch of concepts that we've been kind of beating people over the head with for years without much success, like, you know, syndication and RSS and things like that, right?
Yeah.
So in Facebook, you have the effect of a bunch of RSS feeds, you know, that are neatly integrated into this environment, that are sort of feeding you information about what your friends are doing and even what applications they're loading and unloading. But, you know, nowhere does it say subscribe to this RSS feed, right? Nowhere does it burden you with any of the kind of geeky terminology and clunky stuff, right? So I think that that's actually quite interesting, and what I would argue is that having kind of instilled these concepts in a large number of people, then, you know, it'll be much more straightforward when we get to the point where things are, as I think they inevitably will be, kind of opened up and federated, right? And then it'll be easier for people because they'll have been introduced to it in a way that makes sense to them. And so from that perspective, I'm kind of curious, since the point of Connoteer was to introduce some concepts to people like tagging and to some extent syndication, well, maybe that's not even relevant in Connoteer's.
Well, actually, every page on Connoteer has an RSS link. Like, I think the Delicious is the same, but so every page you see has an RSS equivalent.
That's probably not such a big deal for these folks, right?
Well, sometimes it is and sometimes it isn't. It depends on the communities and the individuals you're talking about. So, for example, there's a whole sort of community that built up around avian flu because one of our journalists, Declan Butler, a Nature journalist who writes a lot about avian flu, among other things, started collecting links to stuff about avian flu in Connoteer, and lots of other people in that research community were using his links as a sort of source of information.
Okay, cool.
And we actually enabled even geotagging within Connoteer, particularly with that use case in mind, so that you can export KML as well from Connoteer, and so you can actually view Declan's avian flu bookmarks in Google Earth if you want to. So, you know, so there were kind of different uses and different approaches built up around different individuals and, you know, different subject areas based on their particular mode of use. And for us, you know, launching a service and then seeing how people use it and then trying to enable those forms of use is sort of very much the approach we take, particularly with Konnotir being our first user-facing social application.
Other aspects of it that are tuned to this community are, well, the way that links actually work, the whole digital object identifier resolution mechanism and infrastructure. You know, because of all of the other work that you folks have done, there's a much different experience in terms of the reliability, the persistence of links in this environment.
DOIs, digital object identifiers that you mentioned, I think you spoke with my colleague Tony Hammond about them a few weeks ago.
I did, yeah.
In another one of your podcasts. They enable us to do a bunch of different things, actually. I mean, one is that they enable us to create persistent links into the content that people are talking about. That's how all scholarly publishers, that's the mechanism they all use in order to link to other publishers' resources and often their own resources in a persistent, future-proof way. But it also allows us to do a couple of other things. One is it gives us an unambiguous identifier for a piece of content. So whenever we get the DOI, that potentially allows us to normalize bookmarks. Even if the URL that people have bookmarked is different, if we know it's the same DOI, we know it refers to the same paper. Because they may well have bookmarked an abstract in one particular location or in a particular abstracting service, as opposed to the full paper on the publisher's site or from some other sort of location. So it allows us to normalize the URLs. We don't do that yet on Konnotir, but that's something that's coming quite soon. The other thing that it allows us to do is it allows us to do some fairly nifty things very easily. So, for example, if you're reading a paper in print, right, so if you're an old-fashioned type who reads print journals, and so a lot of people still do, and you find a paper that you're interested in, you want to bookmark that, what you'd have to do typically is go and find that online and then click your bookmarklet for Konnotir and then bookmark it. But what we can do is, because the DOI typically appears on the paper in the print journal as well, we can allow people to just go into Konnotir, type in the DOI, and then Konnotir knows where to go and find all the information about that paper, including the authors and the title and so forth. And it goes and finds that, then you just enter your tags and you're done. So you don't actually have to go and find it online. It will automatically go and collect all the relevant information for you. So it allows you to bookmark kind of even if you're reading the print journal as well.
What sort of usage pattern do you see in terms of citing articles, let's say, on someone's blog? You know, are you going to see the DOI, or are you going to see one or the other variants of the, you know, the HTML or the PDF, or, you know, what are you likely to see?
Well, I think it's kind of all over the shop, but actually in reality, if you're talking about identifiers, the most commonly used out there in the real world among scientists what is known as PubMed IDs. PubMed is abstract service run by the US National Institutes of Health. They have their own ID for each item that's published. And that's sort of become, in many contexts, with online databases and I guess blogs as well, that's been a kind of a de facto ID standard. So each published item will typically have a PubMed ID and it will have a DOI, and it has other IDs as well in other contexts, but PubMed IDs are very commonly used. I think one of the reasons they're very commonly used is because you can easily link to the abstract on PubMed you know, it will be there. And publishers, I think, including ourselves, haven't always done a great job in encouraging inbound links to people who can't access the full text content and making something useful at the end of that link. So at the end of the DOI link, if you like. I think PubMed IDs are certainly more, in my experience anyway, more widely used among scientists than DOIs. DOIs have some advantages. For example, DOIs are assigned at the before publication, so at the point something's published, it has a DOI, whereas you typically have to wait a little while for an item that's been published to get a PubMed ID. But in most contexts, unless it's very time sensitive, that's not a huge problem for people. Right. So there are a number of sort of different identifier schemes, but DOIs and PubMed IDs are the most obvious ones. But DOIs are used most heavily among publishers and within publishing, whereas PubMed IDs, I think, are probably more heavily used among scientists themselves.
This will never be resolved anytime soon. In fact, maybe it'll never be resolved, period, right? So there are always going to be kind of parallel namespaces going on.
Yeah.
And one of the things I wonder about is, you know, so from time to time, I find myself doing some sort of an investigation that leads me to an original scientific article, and then I try to understand who's cited it, both in the scientific literature, but also in, you know, the general literature and the mainstream press and the blogosphere. It's actually really interesting to be able to synthesize that whole conversation to see how did this idea move out of the scientific community? How was it presented to the mainstream? How was it interpreted and understood? What was the reaction to it? And so I've thought, well, it would be great if there were some kind of a mediating service that could gather together all of these different names for the same thing.
To some degree, those sorts of things already exist. I mean, to give two examples, Crossref, which is the organization, the publishing industry organization that manages the use of DOIs in scholarly publishing, It has a lookup service that publishers use, but it also has a public interface that I'm not very familiar with. But it does have a public interface where you can look, I believe you can do lookups in both directions in terms of you can give it a traditional citation with the name of the journal and the volume and the year and the author names and whatever other information you have, and it will give you back the DOI. Whether it will give you back other identifiers as well, I don't know, but in principle it could. And you can also, you know, take a DOI and look up the metadata associated with that for where that item sits, what the title is, who the authors are, and so forth.
So it could conceivably be the case that, let's say, a Delicious or a Technorati, which are the kinds of general purpose things on the web that I use to sort of figure out who's talking about something, right? It could be the case that they could use this Crossref translating service under the covers in order to sort of expand the scope of individual references to encompass families of references?
Yeah, possibly. What I don't know is whether Crossref, through the Crossref service, you can look up identifiers other than DOIs. I suspect you can't.
It could
be made possible. I mean, another thing is, you know, we'd actually like to expose, insofar as we've got the information in Konnotir, we'd like to expose that information as well. So one of the things we've been thinking about with respect to Konnotir is what Konnotir does when you bookmark a URL is it looks at what kind of URL it is, and if it's a scholarly site that it knows about, it will go and try and extract as much metadata associated with that URL as possible, including things like author and DOI and PubMed ID. What we're sort of working on at the moment is to sort of genericize that service and also expose it so that we can, one reason is so that other applications that we're developing can use it. It's not just sort of tied up in Konnotir, but the other is so that third-party applications could use it, and it could be part of the API we provide, where either we just know how to get that information from that particular site, or we've already got it previously and we've got it cached and we can provide it. So that's another potential. But I mean, another interesting site that you might want to look at, which was actually developed by someone who works at Nature in the web publishing team, but was originally created before he came here. He was at the University of Edinburgh. There's a guy called Ewan Adey who created a site called postgenomic.com. It indexes several hundred, it's probably closer to 1,000 now, scientific blogs, and aggregates blog postings about particular papers or about particular other blog postings or particular items of news.
Yeah.
And one of the things it does is it looks at metadata like DOIs and PubMed IDs and uses that in order to aggregate information, you know, people who are pointing to the same paper, even though they might be using different URLs. So if you go to postgenomic.com, that's a service that does that. It's a little bit like, you can think of it as like a Technorati for science, I suppose, but it's very much focused on aggregating information about, you know, which blogs have talked about these papers or which are the most popular papers.
I think that's really interesting, and it's not just a sort of an esoteric kind of a thing in my mind, because exactly this process of how does scientific knowledge move from the scientific community into the mainstream and then become supportive of some public policy, and how is it interpreted and understood or misunderstood? It's really difficult to sort of trace that migration, but it's really important, right?
Because, I couldn't agree more, and it's a core part of our mission. I mean, you know, so we at Nature Publishing Group, you know, we exist not only to facilitate communication between scientists, but to facilitate communication between science and broader society, and you know, the implications that developments in broader society bring to science, but also in particular that scientific developments bring to people outside science. To talk about something really specific, you know, when scientific research is talked about in, for example, mainstream media or somewhere outside the immediate sphere of scientific publishing, quite often it's stuff that we've published, right? And we would love people to be able to come back and find the original material. But by the time it appears in the New York Times or wherever, it's kind of that link has been lost. It's really difficult to find where that originally came from.
Yes.
Which is a source of constant frustration for us, because we'd love people who want to be able to trace back to the original source material to be able to do so, because we've got it, right? So we want people to come and visit it and come and read that content.
Unfortunately, this is not yet a reflex of newspapers. It's certainly absolutely a reflex in the blogosphere, right? So that's never an issue. To the extent that bloggers can find something to link to, they always will. But newspapers don't like to do that.
We also, I mentioned this earlier, but we also, as publishers, need to do a better job of enabling and encouraging people to link to the stuff we've got. So, mm-hmm. for example, if we provide a URL, but anyone who's not a subscriber is just getting a login screen, right? No one's going to link to that.
Yes.
I mean, I think you discussed this in one of your earlier podcasts as well, because I remember the example of a Nature Biotechnology article that I think was talking about the fact that we were 90% bacterial cells or something.
That's exactly the one, yeah.
You know, in fact, until I listened to your podcast, I didn't realize that was a Nature Biotechnology paper, although I'd heard the story. So it's yeah. really, you know, it is a real problem tracking, you know, the provenance of those ideas. It's a real issue within science because people's careers and reputations and funding are built on that kind of process of who originated ideas and what contributions have you made.
Yes.
But it's also a big deal when it comes to scientific topics that affect broader society, where people actually want to be able to follow back to the source material and make their own judgments rather than necessarily take as gospel what they read in in blogs or in newspapers or whatever.
Yeah. Now, of course, in a lot of cases, those links would take you to, as you said, a login screen, but that's changing. And so along those lines, I wanted to ask you about your new project, Nature Preceedings.
Yeah, so we launched that 2 weeks ago now. I mean, we've obviously been working on it for a much longer time. One way of thinking about it is for people who are sort of familiar with scientific preprint servers is it's a preprint server for biomedicine and for certain other fields as well, like chemistry and earth sciences.
Right.
So in one sense, what we're trying to do is replicate what goes on already in physics and some other areas around physics on the preprint server run at Cornell by Paul Ginsborg, archive.org.
Yes.
So that's not the Internet Archive, Brewster Kahle's thing. That's the archive as in archiv.org, which is a preprint server for physicists, and where when they do a piece of work, they'll write it up as a paper, but they won't immediately send it to a journal. They will put it on archive.org, post it to archive.org, and solicit feedback from the community. And in fact, that behavior predates the existence of the web, and before they used to do it by email, and then before that, they used to post manuscripts to one another. So actually, that behavior is not, it's not like the web suddenly enabled it and they jumped on. It's like they were doing that anyway, and the web has just made it much more efficient. For one reason or another, and we could debate it, although it's unclear as to what the precise reasons are. I think there's a combination of them. But biologists don't do that. That sort of approach to early and open sharing of their results isn't typical in biology, and it varies by discipline, but that's generally the case.
Mm-hmm.
There have been a few attempts, actually, to do something similar in biology or in medicine. I mean, there was something called eBiomed that NIH set up around 1999, and around about the same time, the British Medical Journal set up something called NetPrints for doing something doing the same thing with medical manuscripts. And neither of those really took off. What we've done now is to try and, first of all, we think, you know, we're a few years down the line, and technology has evolved, but in particular, society, including science, has evolved and embraced the web much more mm-hmm. completely, and we see examples outside science of the web enabling kind of radically open collaborative approaches, like, so perhaps, you know, typified by Wikipedia, for example, and seeing those kinds of things working. So people's mindset has changed a bit, I think. But also what we wanted to do was to make sure that we had on board a number of different institutions, because the reason that people don't do that is mainly a social issue. It's not really a technical one.
There's no reward structure.
Well, that's a large part of it. And so we're trying to sort of overcome that problem. So one of the things we're doing on Nature Proceedings is making the items citable, for example, so they can be cited, so people can be rewarded.
Yeah.
And whether they will be cited and whether they will be rewarded is not directly under our control, obviously, but we can at least enable it. And we've got a bunch of other organizations like the Wellcome Trust and the European Bioinformatics Institute, and so on, the British Library, on board to help us in a number of respects. But funders like the Wellcome Trust can help us kind of give us some credibility in the sense of people getting credit for this and it, you know, ultimately affecting their funding. I mean, there's no formal statements to that effect yet, but by having people like that on board and supporting it, we can start to give it more credibility in that area. By having people like the EBI and the British Library on board, we can, they will help, they're going to help, we hope, by mirroring the content, and so we can have a federated system, because you know, why just put this content in the hands of a privately owned commercial organization like Nature Publishing Group, right? This is a community resource. So we're
sure.
trying to kickstart it and enable it, but we don't want to kind of exert control over it, and certainly don't want to be the only owners of the content.
Sure.
So we hope that through sort of combination of things like that, that it now the time is right and it will gain traction and widespread usage. And so far it's been okay. We're getting a steady flow of stuff. We're really pleased with the quality. We're more concerned right now about the quality than the quantity, because we don't want it to become a dumping ground, you know, for any old rubbish. We certainly don't want it to be a platform for people peddling pseudoscience or you know, snake oil, you know. So we want to make sure that it has some credibility, and we do filter the stuff that goes in, but we don't peer review it. That's the difference between Nature Proceedings and a journal.
What kinds of discussions do you see happening around the stuff that's been flowing in so far?
I mean, it is very early to say. So, I mean, there's just a handful of sort of comment threads that have really got going.
Yeah.
I mean, there's one, Jean-Claude Bradley, who's a chemist at Drexel University, posted an item that was actually itself about sort of collaborative approaches to chemistry, basically.
Right.
That kicked off, a quite an interesting discussion about what works and what doesn't work online, and which has all kinds of implications, you know, for the future development of scientific journals as well.
I saw one thing that was in, this may be the thing that you're referring to, it was in the nature of a poster that was, given at a conference someplace, and it was really a vision of what the process of science would look like if fully enabled by the kinds of tools that you're busily creating. Collaborative bookmarking and preprints and the sorts of conversational analysis and visualization that become possible when things are reliably associated to URLs. And it's one of those things that, you know, you look at it and say, well, of course, I mean, this is how things obviously have to be.
Yeah.
There's just no two ways around it.
That is, if you like, the vision that we're pursuing and all the different projects that we're involved in now. And, you know, it's weird because to some people it seems completely obvious, particularly people who think a lot about the web and how the web can enable collaboration. And of course, you're one of those people. To other people, and you know, you have to remember that the average bench scientist really spends no time thinking about that, right? The average bench scientist thinks about their latest experiment that has or hasn't worked, their latest manuscript that they're working on, how they're going to get their next grant renewed. And unless it's kind of immediately obvious to them why something will help them further those ends, then they're not going to be immediately interested in it. I mean, scientists are busy. It's a very competitive environment in terms of securing funding.
And they're desperate for mindshare, though.
They are. And I think, you know, one of the interesting things about science is that the whole, I mean, the currency of science really is reputation, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, one of the things that we've noticed is that scientists have been relatively slow to adopt blogging. And yet, blogging in all sorts of ways is very analogous to the way that scientific communication and reputation works.
Yeah,
you know, with links being citations, and with, you know, bloggers seek to maximize, or many of them do anyway, seek to maximize mind share and attention and reputation, just as scientists would. And yet scientists haven't been very quick to adopt it. And I think the basic reason is that there's no formal reward structure for blogging, right? They enhance their reputation, but when it actually comes down to renewing their grant, the fact they blog probably will make very little difference, if any. In a sense, they're sort of, even if they might be interested in that, they're sort of working within a context that doesn't reward those kinds of quote-unquote non-traditional types of activities.
Mm-hmm. But you can help with that, right? So presumably in your environment now, with its more rigorous structure and rational organization, you can help people with, for example, understanding the degree to which they are attracting attention. You can document that, right? You can measure that.
Absolutely. You know, and so, I mean, we should be able to help in numerous ways, and that's what we're sort of, in the process of discovering by rolling out these various services.
Yeah.
I mean, first of all, we should be able to make it much more immediately obvious to the scientists how it can help them, right? As opposed to, you know, just the sort of, you know, what, for them, you know, why should they set up a blog on Blogger?
Right.
So if we can provide them with an environment where there are other scientists already engaged in some activity, and we can make it very explicit to them how it can help them in their work, we should be able to, and we can tailor the tools to researchers, then it should be more obvious to them how it can help. But you're quite right. We can also start, for example, creating measures of activity and contribution to these various systems. And so something that we've been discussing with funders and others is, you know, how can we, what are the most useful measures that we can create, and how could they feed into the system that then rewards scientists by, you know, measuring their output and deciding how the research money and the tenure positions are going to be doled out. And, you know, to date, and this sounds a bit strange coming from someone who works for a journal publisher, but to date, the way that scientists' output has been measured has been unduly focused on publications in peer-reviewed journals. Now, that is and will continue to be a really, really important part of it, but it's not the only thing they do. And particularly in biology, which in recent years has seen a move from what I would characterize as cottage industry science, where everything from data capture through to analysis and writing the paper happens within one lab among a small group of people, mm-hmm. to a much more industrial scale where you have different groups widely dispersed, perhaps don't even know each other, doing the data capture versus the analysis versus the generation of insights and writing of papers.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, an obvious example of that are the genome initiatives, right? They're pouring out this data of various genomes, and most of the insights generated are by other people. Most of the papers that have been published off the back of those are by other people. Hmm. And you need some way for people to be able to contribute, for example, data, not just, you know, final papers. So if you've got a data set that can be useful to other people, you need some way of putting that out there, of then tracking or someone tracking what use is made of it by other people, and then you eventually gaining credit for that. You know, the basic mechanisms are there in place already for the peer-reviewed literature. They're just not there for things like data sets and blog posts and comments and things like that. But we're certainly trying to enable those kinds of things to be measured.
Well, that's really interesting. I hadn't thought about that. So it's a problem if you're someone who's primarily a producer of data to get citation recognition for that in the works that are referencing the data?
Yeah, because you can't just publish a data set, right? You can't, there's not a journal on the planet, I think, I'm right in saying, that would just take a data set and consider that to be a paper. And what tends to happen is that for a really big important data set, like a new major genome, for example, they'll publish a paper off the back of it and they'll do a bit of analysis to say kind of roughly what the composition of the genome is and some interesting things they may have found. Hmm. But it will be a very quick preliminary analysis. And the real news is not that analysis or the results
of it. It's the data.
It's the data set. But if you like, they kind of have to make this fig leaf of analysis in order to justify publishing a paper.
That's interesting.
But what I really think we need to do is make it possible to publish data sets. Of course, with annotations that help other people understand what the data is, you know, how it was captured and so forth. But just publish the data and be able to get credit for that, which isn't possible at the moment.
That's a great point. What other kinds of possibilities like that do you see in the offing here?
Another obvious one, although it's a bit more niche within the context of science, is code, actually. You know, so again, people who write scientific code, again, don't really get credit for it. And again, the only way they can get credit for it is to write a paper about it. So there's not a good way of publishing code. There's also, to look at the same problem from another direction, there's not a good way for scientists who don't really want to write code but want to use other people's code, want to find a reliable tool for carrying out a particular job, and something that's gone through some rigorous quality checking, because you don't want to base 2 years of experimental work on an algorithm that's broken.
Sure.
You know, there's not a good way for people to find that stuff. So there's another problem stroke opportunity there, in that, you know, scientists who write code don't have a good way of getting credit for it, and therefore they don't really have an incentive for putting it out there in a really polished form. And the flip side is that people, you know, find it hard to find good code. So that's not a kind of a universal problem, because it's important though software is in science, it's not as central as data. So data is a more fundamental and a larger scale problem, I think. But there's an analogous problem with code as well, I think.
Hmm. Really interesting. Well, we've touched on a number of things. There's probably, well, let me just put it this way. What else would you like to inject into this podcast?
Well, so one of the things I think I'd mention is that a lot of the discussions I have, including this one, tend to focus very much on what I would term social software. So we've got this sort of thread of work in our team that social software, that is everything from Connoisseur through to Proceedings and Scintilla and Nature Network, through to actually we're doing quite a bit of stuff in Second Life now, which I would characterize as social software, even though it's not strictly web.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's two other really important areas that we work on. One is audiovisual stuff. So we do a whole bunch of podcasts now, and we're going to be doing more and more with video as well. We do some stuff with video. And that's really important because you'll be more familiar than this with probably than me, but with your experience with podcasting. But the audio medium really lends itself to a different kind of communication than you can get with the written word. And so a couple of years ago, we started a weekly podcast associated with Nature, the journal itself, which has really been a big hit, and we've had a lot of positive feedback about it. But it allows us to engage, well, it allows a couple of different things. It allows the authors to speak about their work in their own terms and much more as kind of human beings, as opposed to the kind of filtered, kind of passive voice kind of account of the science that you get by reading their papers. And it also, just to be really pragmatic about it, allows people to follow this kind of information at times when they couldn't be sitting down reading one of our print journals or browsing the website. So it allows them to do it when they're traveling or when they're working out or when they're doing experiments. And in fact, we've had some people write in and say, can't you make your podcast longer, because I have a lot of, you know, I spend a lot of time in the lab and I need something to listen to. So we're doing more and more of that kind of stuff.
That is a fascinating comment, and I've, you know, it's something that took me completely by surprise as well, because until a couple of years ago when I got into the mode of listening to an enormous amount of stuff, it always seemed like, you know, how could I possibly have the time to listen to something that's an hour long? Then if you're out and you're on an hour and a half hike, you know, the issue is, well, will it actually last long enough?
Exactly. And I save up my podcasts and I listen to them when I'm commuting, and I don't have a very long commute.
Yeah.
But when you add it, I'm going into, you know, there and back, you know, five times a week, actually, it adds up to quite a lot of time. I listen to a lot of podcasts when I'm commuting.
Yeah.
And it's a great use of my time.
Yeah.
So we're doing that. We're going to be doing more in video. And I think one of the areas, for example, where video is particularly promising in science is in protocols, because protocols typically have been shared just in written form. And I think video is a very sort of potentially effective complement to that in terms of showing people how certain protocols are done. And in fact, there's a great website called the Journal of Visualized Experiments, which is at jove.org,
okay,
which is a kind of a YouTube type site, if you like, for scientific protocols. But our own Journal Nature Protocols also accepts videos, and we'd like to build on that. So
what would an example of one of those look like?
It's cookery TV for scientists, right? Instead of having just the cookery book with the recipe in it, right, you're actually watching someone bake the cake, right? In this case, you're watching someone do the experiment or prepare the tissue or you know, whatever it might be. But the combination of having the step-by-step instructions written down and watching someone do it is much more powerful than either one on its own.
Oh, it's huge. It's huge, actually. It's something that's hit me really hard in the last couple of years, that there are just broad swaths of knowledge that people possess that they could sit down and show someone else, and it would immediately transfer.
Exactly. Well, I mean, so screencasting. I mean, we make heavy use of screencasting now, which of course you pioneered. At least that was the first place we came across it, was in the stuff you'd done. And so, you know, and just instead of trying to write out what people should do, why don't you just show them, right? I mean, and this is another example of that. So I mean, the great thing about the audiovisual stuff has been the kind of sort of unintended positive consequences of what we've been doing. I mean, so one thing that came out of our audio stuff is that we had a whole bunch of young Japanese scientists listening to the Nature podcast, and because I'd lived in Japan, I was sort of following the Japanese bloggers and what they were saying about it, and it turns out they were using it as a language training tool, right? They were using it as a way of listening to scientific English, and you can rewind and fast forward and pause and stuff if you don't understand something. They had also asked us, could we provide transcripts, because then they could follow along, they could read while they were listening. And so we started providing transcripts as well for the weekly podcast. And we may start doing some other more specialist stuff for people, for scientists who have English as a second language, so that we can use that medium to help them. So there's all kinds of interesting unintended stuff there, which is also coming out, which is great.
So to come back to your point about credit, I hope it will be the case that through these mechanisms that you're developing, it will be possible for people whose contributions include educating other people by taking the time to record these demonstrations of how to do experimental protocols. I hope that if you know these things feed into your system and other people benefit from the use of those, and that benefit is measurable and the credit flows back to the person who did it, that, you know, that becomes a kind of reward structure that will encourage this behavior. It would be great to see.
Yeah, no,
happen.
I couldn't agree more. And that's certainly something that, you know, that's the kind of thing that we'd like to try and enable. And then in terms of how credit actually accrues, again, that's a more general social problem that involves funders and institutions and the scientists themselves. But certainly we're in the business of trying to enable that kind of stuff.
That's fabulous.
There was one other thing I was going to mention, which was scientific databases, and so, which is another area that we're very kind of heavily involved in. And I think they're often overlooked, because there's these sort of, when you're talking about online scientific information, there's these two big domains. There's the journals, the literature, and then there's the databases that hold everything from gene sequences to protein structures to, you know, astronomical data. And in many domains and for many scientists, the databases are every bit as important a source of information as the journals. For some people, they're more important. Scientific publishers often don't get involved very much in databases. We've got a number of projects in that area where we're collaborating with academic groups who have databases and working with them either to curate the data or put it through peer review or provide content around the data. So we're also trying to experiment with what kind of value we can add in that context as well, which is really important. My view is that journals and databases are getting the border between them is getting fuzzier and fuzzier. So journals have basically all moved online now. They're being updated much more frequently. They become searchable. In some ways, they're becoming more structured. They're becoming a little bit more like databases in essence, right? On the other hand, databases are starting to take more seriously the issue of reviewing and curating the content, of making things citable and archival, so that if you cite something, you know, it's got an unambiguous stable, globally unique identifier. And if you use that, you know that people in years to come, when they access it, will be able to see exactly the same data that you're seeing now. There's all the issues around citability and archiving as well, that databases, I think, are taking me more and more seriously, and that have been, you know, long-standing issues with respect to the journals. And so as they sort of learn from one another in their now shared online environment, not only are they starting to get linked up better, which is a start, but they're also starting to take on some of the characteristics of the other. And so I think in time we'll see journals and databases, people just, you know, will find have a harder and harder time saying whether something's a journal or a database, because they'll start looking more and more like each other. Hmm. And we have one or two projects, in particular something called the Molecule Pages, where it's a journal, but it's also a database, right? So it's basically a peer-reviewed journal, but it sits in a relational database. And so we're trying to experiment with how can you have the best of both worlds.
Including even the ability to trace back the history of the changes to the database.
That's right, exactly. Yeah. So when there's a change to a record, that's documented and people can see that either as a list of changes, or they can literally go, you know, step back through previous versions of that record and find the one that was being cited in a particular context.
Excellent. Well, you are just having loads of fun, I think.
It is. Oh, it's a lot of fun, yeah. We keep ourselves busy and we have a hoot as well.
Well, thanks so much, Timo.
Great. Thanks, John.
You've been listening to Interviews with Innovators with John Udell.
The Conversations Network is looking for part-time website editors and audio engineers. It's not enough to quit your day job, but we do pay small amounts for each published program. For more information, visit the conversationsnetwork.org website. Our audio files are delivered by Limelight Networks, the high-performance content delivery network for digital media. Thank you, Limelight, for your support of the Conversations Network. The post-production audio engineer for this program was John Udell. Our website editor was Niels Makel. The series producer is Niels Makel.
This is Phil Wendley. I look forward to bringing you another edition of Interviews with Innovators next time on IT Conversations.